Awesome. Well, I wanted to, first of all, welcome you guys after that lunch. There's always two spots you don't want to have, right? The spot right before lunch and the spot right after lunch, right? So we'll try to keep you guys awake. And I just want to thank you guys. I want to introduce myself. My name's Ryan Prasad, as you can see. I'm the Director of Business Intelligence at BCLC. Yeah, sounds like a cool gig. And what my job is I get to look at data information on a daily basis. We have casino information that comes through, digital information that comes through, as well as lottery information. And we use real behavior data as well as research to come up with information and insights for our business. So when Jamie asked me to facilitate this session around what are we actually trying to prevent, I was super excited and nerded out for a little bit about it. And I'm really excited to be here. The other weird thing about right now is no pressure, but they gave us the biggest room. So, you know, my panelists are ready to go and make sure you guys are excited. So what we're here to talk about today is really some of the things we've talked about this morning already, which is around this understanding or identification of what does risk look like and how do we go about measuring it. And I think we've had a few kind of conversations on this before where do we actually have an understanding of what does risk look like? And if we do, what are we doing about it? And then the other piece of it is, how are we going about measuring that today? So today, we're going to be talking all about that and interactive session, so feel free to ask questions as we go. I'm going to ask the panelists to come up right now, and then we'll introduce them and get started. So a round of applause for the three panelists we have. All right. Cool. Look at these guys. You're right. I was just noticing Judith's ankle, knee thing there. They let her out.
I'm not allowed to leave the perimeter.
Yeah. awesome. So I just wanted to introduce the panelists. I'm going to start off actually in the center here introducing Dr. Luke Clark. Luke is the director for the Center of Responsible Gambling, Gambling Research at the University of British Columbia. His research focuses on psychology of gambling behavior in terms of psychological features of different forms of gambling, neurobiological markers for individuals who are vulnerable. He has published over 150 papers, so that makes him legit. For sure. But what makes it more legit is in 2015, Dr. Clark was awarded the Scientific Achievement Award by the National Center of Responsible Gambling. So definitely want to welcome him here.
Thank you.
Awesome. And then you've already met her earlier today in today's morning session, but I wanted to introduce Judith Glenn. She's a co-founder and principal at Strategic Science. She has over 30 years of experience, so you started when you were like 15 or something. So her experience is actually really interesting. I was reading this. It's public policy, scientific research, marketing, and communication. Like, that's pretty diverse in terms of policy, research, and marketing. So definitely want to welcome that and appreciate that. She has international experience, different advisory roles, Responsible Gambling Trust, Asian Pacific Association for Gambling Studies, the International Think Tank on Gambling Research, Policy, and Practice. She managed the world's largest gambling fund from 2000 to 2012. And in 2012, she co-founded an organization, a company called Strategic Science, where they provide research and social responsibility consulting in gambling, obesity, and substance abuse. So we want to welcome Judith here today.
Thank you.
And then last but not least, all the way from Norway. we want to welcome Pierre Carlson. He's an advisor in responsible gambling. He's at Norse Tipping, which is a Norwegian state lottery. He's been there since 2002. Over 25 years of experience, mainly on the business side, marketing, product operations, CRM, ID and payment solutions, which is really relevant now. And over the past 4 or 5 years, he's been focusing on the responsible gaming team at Norse Tipping. And really what his role is linking the traditional kind of RG-specific frameworks with actual operations. So we're definitely excited for him to be here. So thanks a lot. All right. So to kick this off, this was a question. I don't know about you guys, but obviously I'm a nerd, and I always have, like, one data point that I always go to, like my go-to data point. And I probably overuse it and misuse it all the time. So I wanted to ask the panelists as a nice warm-up, what's one of those go-to data points or stats that you use in your day-to-day job that you could share with us? Maybe Per, we can start with you.
Yeah, I can start. First of all, I would like to quote myself on something
quote
here.
Quote yourself,
yeah.
Good.
Oh, yeah, because prevention is about something not to happen. And how do you measure something that really didn't happen? So that's quite a... Did you understand?
Why are we here?
So with that said, we have a lot of KPIs, RGA KPIs set up. And one of them is my favorite, which is called the PlayScan Index. Anyone heard of PlayScan? It's like a risk detection system analysis.
A lot of shaking heads.
So it's like a scorecard. We made it ourselves. PlayScan didn't make it. And we score ourselves on, for instance, if you have a red player, at risk player, going from red to green, we give ourselves plus 3 points. And if it goes from green to red, it's minus 3 points the other way. So in the, from the start to the end of the year, get the scorecard. And we try to end up on the plus side at the end of the year.
So is it by player or by customer?
By customer.
Wow.
Yeah. So we have like a 0 point in the start of the year, and try to end up on the plus side at the end of the year. And we have from week to week, PlayScan Index measured.
That's awesome. The other piece of information on that, I'm not sure if you guys know, but in Norway they actually have mandatory account. So across their three product areas, they're able to track customers full. Mm. So it's really useful that you can look at that risk tracking not only in one of the channels, but
through all channels. Yeah, it's the same idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Luke.
Thanks.
It's
great to be here. My a lot of my go-to stats are not that fun. So I'm trying to think of about a neutral stat, and something that I came across last week is the proportion of the North American population with smartphones. So of North American adults with a smartphone.
Okay, don't answer it yet. What do you guys think it is? Shoot out the percentage. 98%, this guy said.
Wow, you're a bit high. That's a bit
87?
High. Across adults, it is 81, but if you just look at the 18 to 30 sector, yeah, it's 96% in the young adults. So
he's targeting young adults actually.
For the young adult market, and even for over half of kids under 11 have their own smartphone now. So,
whoa.
You know, we can see so many of the things that we all do on smartphones, but one thing you can do on a smartphone is gamble, of course. So that's very relevant to what we're talking about today. So that's my neutral stat.
Awesome. Judith?
I mean, I'm fickle, so it would probably be a different answer yesterday and tomorrow, but I would have to say that that decline rate for ATM withdrawal requests on the gaming floor, and not just because it's a little bit shocking, but because it also tells us that there may be places we're not looking for fairly simple indicators of risk or opportunities to interact with a player in a way that reinforces, you know, safe gambling practices. So I like it for that reason as well. Like it shocks us, it tells us we need to do something, but I also like the way that it gives us, might be a bit close. But I like the way that it gives us, you know, kind of a new opportunity to think about whether or not we can inject some kind of social responsibility into that transaction.
Yeah, and how did you guys discover that, actually?
Actually, I was at the Global Gaming Expo, and I stopped by a booth where the company did, they basically do tracking, kind of audit tracking of money on the gambling floor. And so they work with gambling operators, they work with payment providers, they had done the analysis and come up with this statistic, and I think they presented it at UNLV, the company that I was referring to. I don't know if I should name them just in case. Anyway.
Some type of thing, yeah.
In any event, yeah. And I remember being quite shocked, and it spurred quite a conversation. I was, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. The reason I ask is just around like where we traditionally may go to get information, not realizing that sometimes those types of informations are right there from other sources, right?
Exactly, and that's why I like it, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Well, thank you guys for that. That was kind of my fun icebreaker there. So as we, you know, again, like what we're here to talk about is really around what does risk look like and how do we go about measuring that? But I think before we kind of get into that or dive deep into that, what I would like for you guys to maybe talk to us about is maybe just giving us a lay of the land in terms of, you know, we have prevalence studies, we have, you know, behavioral analytics, predictive analytics, and all these things, but today in kind of responsible gambling, how do you guys kind of see the evolution in terms of where we are today versus maybe where we were, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago in general? So maybe Luke, if you don't mind kicking that off for us.
Yeah, I can take that. One of the things I'm loving about this meeting already is how thematic things are, and you know, I think we've already heard this morning about you know, this transition that the field is at a very interesting point right now, and we're seeing this process in many different parts of the world. We've spent 2 or 3 decades thinking about gambling problems at a very clinical level, thinking about a diagnosis with a set of criteria, and we can get that through an interview, we can maybe get that through a questionnaire like the PGSI, and we go out and assess prevalence rates and look at change in prevalence over time and so on and so forth. And I think about that as, I would call that a medical model, and it thinks about gambling problems as this, it implies a very binary thing that a person either has or doesn't have. And what we are seeing with the public health framework and a move towards a public health approach is recognizing that gambling harms are really much more distributed and spread throughout the population than that. So some of the kind of example harms that people talk about that would not conventionally be considered symptoms, this could be an inability to pay bills, an inability to go on holiday, cancelling holidays because of gambling related losses, sleep problems, selling personal belongings. And of course, those things don't just affect the gambler, but affect spouses, children, friends, extended families. So that in no way diminishes the severity of gambling addiction at the end of that spectrum, but it does suggest quite a different strategy that doesn't just focus on getting people into treatment, but focuses across the full spectrum with a range of programs and interventions.
I would actually add to that the previous kind of conceptualization wasn't very helpful to operators and regulators in many ways, because they were looking for disordered individuals or signs of disorder rather than behaviors that exhibit risk of harm. And so I think that the newer way of thinking about it is to look for what would harm look like, and we have the taxonomy and the conceptual model, and then what behavioral indicators might we see, say, in a gambling operation that can indicate that a person is at risk of harm, and then intervene accordingly with kind of an escalating response. And I think that what that does is it in some ways it addresses the stigma issue, certainly for the gambling setting, because it says we're not looking for disordered individuals, we're looking for behaviors that aren't, you know, that risk harm, and when we see those behaviors, we'll respond accordingly. Mm-hmm.
Like maybe Luke, like back to that, like how do you think that evolution actually happened? Because though kind of moving from the traditional kind of medical model to where we are now, where we're, because I think we sometimes don't really do ourselves justice in a sense sometimes when we're like, we have all this research and all this information and we maybe haven't evolved where we actually have, right? And this is not about patting ourselves on the back or anything, but the idea of what influenced that kind of evolution?
Like I think it's sophistication in measurement, which is crucial today. And I think the key piece of data that emerged there, which was talked about in the last session, I think, is the work from Brown and Langham and colleagues in Australia, where they're looking at this spectrum of harm throughout different levels of gambling involvement, where you can see that these milder, effectively, harms are so common in the population that actually most of the gambling harm gets attributable to people who would not meet a clinical threshold. So 85% of the overall harm in the population in their studies in Australia are coming from the low and moderate risk groups. Only 15% of the total harm is from the problem gambling category. And that really caused a lot of people to change the way that they thought about this state of affairs.
Anything to that?
Good.
Okay. So on that point, I think we've been talking about this again around the State of the Union on, do we actually have an understanding of what at-risk play is? And, you know, my quantitative survey brain is, if you guys were to evaluate us, would you say we're at a one in terms of we don't really know what risk looks like and we have no clue versus maybe a five where we're like, actually, we know exactly what risk is and we kind of have definitions. Like, where would you say we are in my basic scale?
If you ask me, I would probably say between four and five. We know for sure what problem gambling is. Mm-hmm. We know how to identify it. The problem is how to deal with it, mm-hmm. and what to do. So I don't know if you agree with me.
I think I would give us a bit of a higher score, maybe like a 6.5, because I think that, as an example, the work done by the Division on Addiction on the earliest kind of predictive modeling work that was done in our field, you know, over and over again, there were four sets of indicators that were strongly correlated with self-exclusion or developing a gambling problem or, you know, responding on a brief screen that suggested you had a gambling problem. Many different events they were trying to predict. And in some cases, just a concept called extreme play. And in each case, there were these kind of like four types of behaviors that were good, clear indicators of risk. There's been lots of work to build on that. So I would say, yeah, we do know what risk behavior looks like. There are places we're not looking yet, which would be the reason for the part of the reason for the 6.5. Things like ATM withdrawals or how players access cash to gamble, stuff like that, communication behaviors, those kinds of things. But the other reason I would not give us a higher score is because we're not doing what we need to do with that information yet. Mm-hmm. We're not actually intervening when we see risk behavior mm-hmm. in some kind of an escalated response protocol. It isn't there.
You just changed the scale on me and went to 10.
I was
so don't worry.
Yeah,
I got you. It's okay. I got you, though. Because like, you did one of these, and like, it's a 5-point scale. But
oh,
she went to the 10.
Oh, yeah,
it's okay.
Translate it back.
It's okay. It's probably going
to
be a 3. And a 3.
So I actually gave it a lower score than Pear.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay.
Sorry. No, cool. I missed that, Pear.
No, but I think the point, and I'll get to you, too, is I think if we're a 6.5 out of 10 or we're a 4 out of 5, like the conversation here is, and we'll get to Luke, is, you know, we're there. What's the actual challenges that we're dealing with right now as an industry? If we're kind of saying we have information, we have some information on behavioral risks, what do we actually think the barrier is for us to move it to action? Like, where would you kind of see that being? Because that's kind of why we're here, is like, you know, we had this conversation earlier today about industry and academics needing to come closer and there's more collaboration needing to happen. Okay, we get that point. But in terms of, we have some information out here, you know, what is it that you think we need to move us into action?
First of all, you need data. Mm-hmm. If you have data, you can also try and start testing what works, what don't work. And you always get this ongoing results. To go further, and when you find something that works, you could try A/B testing more and more and more, and maybe in the end, you get this best practice, and you have to share with the other operators, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But data is crucial here. If you don't have data, you don't have the answers, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think we're at a, you know, another shift from identifying to knowing how to respond to that knowledge. I think we can measure the signs of problem gambling very well and very reliably. One of the challenges with behavioral tracking is that you can't ask people questions about symptoms or about harms. You're trying to infer that from behavioral expressions, and there's another step there. But the bigger challenge is more how do we actually use that knowledge to guide a response and an intervention?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would add, I agree with those barriers. I would add that I think even without intending it, we're having a bit of a romance with predictive analytics. You know, it's so lovely and delightful to keep refining these models.
Yeah.
We have to actually do something with them. Mm-hmm. And that predictive modeling has enabled us to learn amazing things. Like, for example, over time, we can see trajectories of play and how certain indicators escalate, you know. And so I think that to some extent, we're so focused on getting this perfect model mm-hmm. that we're missing the fact that we've already learned so much that we could be putting into action in gambling settings.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I was just thinking, I'm going off the script, obviously, sorry. But I was just thinking about this whole thing about the testing and learn and willing to take the risks to actually try to evaluate what we're doing. We take those risks in, like, marketing, for example, where the digital world is now allowing us a platform to test messages, test creative elements, test all these things, and... So is the barrier for us trying to do that from a player health perspective or an RG perspective is because we just aren't entirely sure about the space still? Or, like, what would you guys kind of say, like, the risk of or kind of the barrier is for not trying some of these tests?
I think if you compare it to sales and marketing, we're quite good at using the data sets. I mean, CRM, our messages sent, everything, relevant messages. And if you bring the same thought into the RG features,
mm-hmm.
and you can still use the same set of business rules, actually,
mm-hmm.
to start going there.
But what would you say the barrier, though, is for us to start going there, then?
I'm not sure, but you just have to start. It's like intervening on proactive calls. The first telephone call is always the worst one.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to start.
Yeah.
Just a simple.
Yeah. Do you guys have anything to add on?
Well, I was going to say, and start small.
Yeah.
Start, you know, like, look at your 98th percentile on session length. Or, you know, start with something fairly simple that's a reliable indicator that the player might be experiencing risk. And start with a very light touch on the intervention. Maybe you start with just promoting self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you encourage self-control. Say, hey, maybe we could steer you to these tools. You might benefit from a self-assessment. You know, like, so. Just I think we need a framework that says it's okay to start small with simple indicators and an escalating response. And I think people will start to do it. But it is a bit scary. We need to plunge into the pool.
Mm-hmm. Before I give everybody a chance to ask a question, or if there's any question in the audiences, maybe just on that point, Judith, if you were to be asked, like, how would you define what at-risk play is, like, what would you kind of say that is today? Yeah. Or what would be...
So, I mean, I think risky play is play that... If you look at the definition of kind of any form of addiction... It's persistence in the face of negative consequences. So I think that, you know, from that we can say that when players are doing things that a lot of other players don't do, You know, in the face of a series of losses, the normal thing is to scale down your bets and to step away from the machine and take a break. If you start escalating, you know, well, we know that that's someone who's likely in a bit of trouble, mm-hmm. panicking, anxious, needing to pay for a wedding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Luke, in terms of defining what it would look like?
Yeah, like as a psychologist, I would naturally approach things in a similar way. But another way that we can look at this is a data-driven approach. So we've been doing some work at the Center for Gambling Research using a year data set from the PlayNow platform, and it's from the e-casino section, so the slot machines and table games. And we have about 30,000 users in that data set, and they're making about 500 million bets. And we're building machine learning models to predict self-exclusion as the outcome there. And we put a lot of betting behavioral inputs into the model. So we put 20 inputs in, which reflects the kinds of things that Judith's been talking about there, the intensity, the frequency. We've got some variability measures. We've got, we haven't really got trajectory measures, but you could think about trajectories too. And we are seeing 75% performance accuracy just off of those kind of play measures. So that would be compared to a 50% chance level. We're at around 75%, where we know very little about who these people are at all. That's all the data that we're working with. You can then say which are the variables there that have the most signal, mm-hmm. and the single variable that we see that has by far the most signal is the variability in the bet-to-bet spend. Mm-hmm. So it's not a player who is consistently betting high, it's a player who from one session to the next is low one day and high the next. And what we need to figure out next is if that is in itself a kind of expression of chasing, or if this is more about access to funds and when payday is and things like that. But in that sense, we're letting the models determine the variables that give you the most leverage.
I do think, though, there's a bit of a problem with having the target be self-exclusion or, you know, some measure of gambling disorder.
Right.
You know, and I'm not sure I have the solution. There are a lot of minds here who have contributed to that conversation. But certainly the whole trend toward identifying what behaviors are protective or at least not risky and then trying to, you know, push players toward those behaviors teaches us something too. So instead of trying to identify the folks who will self-exclude in the future, can we identify the folks who aren't exercising kind of well-documented and evidenced safe gambling practices?
Right. I think like for that conversation too is if, you know, VSC isn't the dependent variable that we should be focusing on as an example for the data kind of nerds here, because there's some false positives that you mentioned and these other things. Mm. But if one of the variables that you guys just agreed on is variance of play, you mean identifying that within your data could be a trigger and a target for, you know, operators to say, okay, we're going to look at, you know, this is the normal level of variance that we have. Anytime a player goes outside of that, is there an action or something? Would that be something similar to where we could probably go, I guess? And I think you have the experience to tell us if that's something that you guys would do there.
But again, I have to say that if you have just a limited set of data, mm-hmm. you don't have the whole picture.
Sure.
So you need actually a single point of customer data. Mm-hmm. Where you can track all this customer behavior and also everything really with the customer. I don't know if that was the answer for the question.
Sure. But, no, I get it. So it's hard to just look at it by just one channel, for example.
Of course. You need to have the total picture.
Yeah.
You could still just respond lightly to some of those individual behaviors, but you do start to need what I think you're implying, which is some form of case management, mm-hmm. where you're understanding that for some risk indicators, we need to take a closer look. Is this variability happening in an escalating fashion over the last few weeks? Or is it a one-time thing where someone got carried away and maybe had too much to drink.
We had fun last night, okay?
Like it was like, like someone might have last night, you know.
Any questions from the audience on that? Because we kind of talked a little bit about that. Oh, yeah, Sam. Oh, we have a mic runner here. Okay.
Hi. The word data has come up quite a bit in the conversation so far. I'm curious. I'm a marketer by trade, and so there's kind of two forces at play that seem to be coming for marketers. So one is the technology and what we can do with the data that we have at our disposal. The other is privacy. And it seems like the two are at odds with one another. I'm curious if any of you feel that as privacy becomes more of a public issue, do you see it forcing us to take a few steps back in terms of the progress that we've made from a player health perspective?
I would actually do the opposite. I think that what we should do is tell our players, research shows that these are the kinds of behaviors that these are behaviors that we believe exhibit risk for harm, and we're going to be tracking these behaviors, and we're going to talk to you, we're going to communicate with you if we're concerned. Imagine doing that as an operator. I think you'd skirt the privacy concerns quite effectively, and people would appreciate you for it.
I think that's a very good question, because when you ask the player himself, when you intervene and call him, for instance, he would probably say, why didn't you call me before? So until now we have...
Well, and that's a good point, because I think that the sensitivity around privacy is often voiced by the operator, but I think that if you surveyed your players, they think you know everything about them. Mm. They do. They think you know how much oxygen they're breathing in your facility, really. So these concerns about privacy should be checked with your players. Yeah. Do you think we know these things about you? Do you mind if we use them to help you?
And if you know it, why don't you tell me?
Yes.
They assume that everything's being tracked.
They do. They assume it. Because it is in every other aspect of our lives, you know?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay.
Increasingly.
Within banking, for instance, if you open your bank and only see the 70% of the information, how would you react?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the audience? Jamie? Yeah.
Hi. Per, can you just talk a little bit about the phone calls, the protocols around that, and the reception, how receptive players have been for receiving that phone call?
I'm not sure if did you hear Jacob Johnson here last year? A few of you maybe did. But when you call the at-risk players, it's the highest risk players. And, well, the protocol looking for the words.
Criteria?
No, it's like the highest risk players defined by the play scan system. Mm-hmm. So it's the last percent of the players that we do call.
Mm-hmm. But I think the learning that we heard last year was around the openness of those players of getting that information, and I think. Did we see some changes in terms of their behavior once they got that phone call?
Oh, yeah. So more than 60% of the person that we called, they changed their behavior afterwards.
More than 60?
Yeah, massively.
Excellent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a big number.
Yeah, and I think that's an example of small tests. Like, we identified some indicators that these players are potentially having a challenge or may be just identified in terms of at risk. You called, like, it's the most invasive thing in terms of giving them a phone call. And the fact that you're seeing, 60% of them changing their behaviors, I guess. Was there any other learnings in that space?
No, it's more about giving information, because it's not like pointing a finger at you. It's like giving them the right information to make the right choices. Mm-hmm. So with the information given, they take the good choices. Take them by the hand and down the road and take the choices. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The work I've seen by Johnson there also has an email condition as well, right? And the phone condition does do something about that,
so it's
personal contact
that
has a
It's much
has
better
a benefit.
By phone.
Yeah. And I think they were talking about, or we were having that conversation this morning around the emotional component of this,
exactly.
Or the human component of this, and not forgetting that part. I don't know, Judith, you have a perspective of that.
Well, I was going to ask you, how did your staff respond? Did you measure anything to do with like satisfaction, or did you interview them, the ones who did the calls? How did they feel?
Very comfortable, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to, first of all, welcome you guys after that lunch. There's always two spots you don't want to have, right? The spot right before lunch and the spot right after lunch, right? So we'll try to keep you guys awake. And I just want to thank you guys. I want to introduce myself. My name is Ryan Prasad, as you can see. I'm the Director of Business Intelligence at BCLC. Yeah, sounds like a cool gig. And what my job is I get to look at data information on a daily basis. We have casino information that comes through, digital information that comes through, as well as lottery information. And we use real behavior data as well as research to come up with information and insights for our business. So when Jamie asked me to facilitate this session around what are we actually trying to prevent, I was super excited and nerded out for a little bit about it. And I'm really excited to be here. The other weird thing about right now is no pressure, but they gave us the biggest room. So, you know, my panelists are ready to go and make sure you guys are excited. So what we're here to talk about today is really some of the things we've talked about this morning already, which is around this understanding or identification of what does risk look like and how do we go about measuring it. And I think we've had a few kind of conversations on this before where do we actually have an understanding of what does risk look like? And if we do, what are we doing about it? And then the other piece of it is, how are we going about measuring that today? So today, we're going to be talking all about that and interactive session, so feel free to ask questions as we go. I'm going to ask the panelists to come up right now, and then we'll introduce them and get started. So a round of applause for the three panelists we have. All right. Cool. Look at these guys. Right. I was just noticing Judith's ankle, knee thing there. They let her out.
I'm not allowed to leave the perimeter.
Yeah. awesome. So I just wanted to introduce the panelists. I'm going to start off actually in the center here introducing Dr. Luke Clark. Luke is the director for the Center of Responsible Gambling, Gambling Research at the University of British Columbia. His research focuses on psychology of gambling behavior in terms of psychological features of different forms of gambling, neurobiological markers for individuals who are vulnerable. He has published over 150 papers, so that makes him legit. For sure. But what makes it more legit is in 2015, Dr. Clark was awarded the Scientific Achievement Award by the National Center of Responsible Gambling. So definitely want to welcome him here. Awesome. And then you've already met her earlier today in today's morning session, but I wanted to introduce Judith Glenn. She's the co-founder and principal at Strategic Science. She has over 30 years of experience, so you started when you were like 15 or something. So her experience is actually really interesting. I was reading this. It's public policy, scientific research, marketing, and communication. Like, that's pretty diverse in terms of policy, research, and marketing. So definitely want to welcome that and appreciate that. She has international experience, different advisory roles, Responsible Gambling Trust, Asian Pacific Association for Gambling Studies, the International Think Tank on Gambling Research, Policy, and Practice. She manages the world's largest gambling fund from 2000 to 2012. And in 2012, she co-founded an organization, a company called Strategic Science, where they provide research and social responsibility consulting in gambling, obesity, and substance abuse. So we want to welcome Judith here today.
Thank you.
And then last but not least, all the way from Norway. we want to welcome Pierre Carlson. He's an advisor in responsible gambling. He's at Norse Tipping, which is a Norwegian state lottery. He's been there since 2002. Over 25 years of experience, mainly on the business side, marketing, product operations, CRM.
ID and payment solutions, which is really relevant now. And over the past 4 or 5 years, he's been focusing on the responsible gaming team at Norse Tipping. And really what his role is linking the traditional kind of RG-specific frameworks with actual operations. So we're definitely excited for him to be here. So thanks a lot. All right. So to kick this off, this was a question. I don't know about you guys, but obviously I'm a nerd, and I always have like one data point that I always go to, like my go-to data point. And I probably overuse it and misuse it all the time. So I wanted to ask the panelists as a nice warm-up, what's one of those go-to data points or stats that you use in your day-to-day job that you could share with us? Maybe, Per, we can start with you.
Yeah, I can start. First of all, I would like to quote myself on something
quote
here.
Quote yourself,
yeah.
Good.
Oh, yeah. Because prevention is about something not to happen. And how do you measure something that really didn't happen? So that's quite a... Did you understand?
Why are we here?
So with that said, we have a lot of KPIs, RGA KPIs, set up. And one of them is my favorite, which is called the PlayScan Index. Anyone heard of PlayScan? It's like a risk detection system analysis.
A lot of shaking heads.
So it's like a scorecard. We made it ourselves. PlayScan didn't make it. And we score ourselves on, for instance, if you have a red player, at-risk player, going from red to green, we give ourselves plus 3 points. And if it goes from green to red, it's minus 3 points the other way. So in the, from the start to the end of the year, get the scorecard, and we try to end up on the plus side at the end of the year.
So is it by player or by customer?
By customer.
Wow.
Yeah. So we have like a 0 point in the start of the year, and try to end up on the plus side at the end of the year. And we have from week to week, the PlayScan Index measured.
That's awesome. The other piece of information on that, I'm not sure if you guys know, but in Norway they actually have mandatory account. So across their three product areas, they're able to track customers full. So it's really useful that you can look at that risk tracking not only in one of the channels, but
through all channels. Yeah, it's the same idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Luke.
Thanks. Am I?
Yeah.
It's great to be here. A lot of my go-to stats are not that fun. So I'm trying to think of about a neutral stat, and something that I came across last week is the proportion of the North American population with smartphones. So of North American adults with a smartphone.
Okay, don't answer it yet. What do you guys think it is? Shoot out the percentage. 98%, this guy said.
Wow. You're a bit high. That's a bit
87?
High.
87?
Across adults, it is 81. But if you just look at the 18 to 30 sector, yeah, it's 96% in the young adults. So
he's targeting young adults actually.
For the young adult market, and even for over half of kids under 11 have their own smartphone now. So,
whoa.
You know, we can see so many of the things that we all do on smartphones, but one thing you can do on a smartphone is gamble, of course. So that's very relevant to what we're talking about today. So that's my neutral stat.
Awesome. Judith?
I mean, I'm fickle, so it would probably be a different answer yesterday and tomorrow, but I would have to say that that decline rate for ATM withdrawal requests on the gaming floor, and not just because it's a little bit shocking, but because it also tells us that there may be places we're not looking for fairly simple indicators of risk or opportunities to interact with a player in a way that reinforces, you know, safe gambling practices. So I like it for that reason as well. Like it shocks us, it tells us we need to do something, but I also like the way that it gives us, might be a bit close. But I like the way that it gives us, you know, kind of a new opportunity to think about whether or not we can inject some kind of social responsibility into that transaction.
Yeah, and how did you guys discover that actually?
Actually, I was at the Global Gaming Expo, and I stopped by a booth where the company did they basically do tracking, kind of audit tracking of money on the gambling floor. And so they work with gambling operators, they work with payment providers, they had done the analysis and come up with this statistic. And I think they presented it at UNLV, the company that I was referring to. I don't know if I should name them just in case. Anyway.
Some type of thing, yeah.
In any event, yeah. And I remember being quite shocked, and it spurred quite a conversation.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. The reason I ask is just around like where we traditionally may go to get information, not realizing that sometimes those types of informations are right there from other sources, right?
Exactly, and that's why I like it, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Well, thank you guys for that. That was kind of my fun icebreaker there. So as we, you know, again, like what we're here to talk about is really around what does risk look like and how do we go about measuring that? But I think before we kind of get into that or dive deep into that, what I would like for you guys to maybe talk to us about is maybe just giving us a lay of the land in terms of, you know, we have prevalence studies, we have, you know, behavioral analytics, predictive analytics, and all these things, but today in kind of responsible gambling, how do you guys kind of see the evolution in terms of where we are today versus maybe where we were, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago in general? So maybe Luke, if you don't mind kicking that off for us.
Yeah, I can take that. One of the things I'm loving about this meeting already is how thematic things are, and you know, I think we've already heard this morning about you know, this transition that the field is at a very interesting point right now, and we're seeing this process in many different parts of the world. We've spent 2 or 3 decades thinking about gambling problems at a very clinical level, thinking about a diagnosis with a set of criteria, and we can get that through an interview, we can maybe get that through a questionnaire like the PGSI, and we go out and assess prevalence rates and look at change in prevalence over time and so on and so forth. And I think about that as, I would call that a medical model, and it thinks about gambling problems as this, it implies a very binary thing that a person either has or doesn't have. And what we are seeing with the public health framework and a move towards a public health approach is recognizing that gambling harms are really much more distributed and spread throughout the population than that. So some of the kind of example harms that people talk about that would not conventionally be considered symptoms, this could be an inability to pay bills, an inability to go on holiday, cancelling holidays because of gambling related losses, sleep problems, selling personal belongings. And of course, those things don't just affect the gambler, but affect spouses, children, friends, extended families. So that in no way diminishes the severity of gambling addiction at the end of that spectrum, but it does suggest quite a different strategy that doesn't just focus on getting people into treatment, but focuses across the full spectrum with a range of programs and interventions.
I would actually add to that the previous kind of conceptualization wasn't very helpful to operators and regulators in many ways, because they were looking for disordered individuals or signs of disorder rather than behaviors that exhibit risk of harm. And so I think that the newer way of thinking about it is to look for what would harm look like, and we have the taxonomy and the conceptual model, and then what behavioral indicators might we see, say, in a gambling operation that can indicate that a person is at risk of harm, and then intervene accordingly with kind of an escalating response. And I think that what that does is it in some ways it addresses the stigma issue, certainly for the gambling setting, because it says we're not looking for disordered individuals, we're looking for behaviors that aren't, you know, that risk harm, and when we see those behaviors, we'll respond accordingly.
like maybe Luke, can, like back to that, like how do you think that evolution actually happened? Because of kind of moving from the traditional kind of medical model to where we are now, where we're, because I think we sometimes don't really do ourselves justice in a sense sometimes when we're like, we have all this research and all this information and we maybe haven't evolved where we actually have, right? And this is not about patting ourselves on the back or anything, but the idea of what influenced that kind of evolution?
Like I think it's sophistication in measurement, which is crucial today. And I think the key piece of data that emerged there, which was talked about in the last session, I think, is the work from Brown and Langham and colleagues in Australia, where they're looking at this spectrum of harm throughout different levels of gambling involvement, where you can see that these milder, effectively, harms are so common in the population that actually most of the gambling harm gets attributable to people who would not meet a clinical threshold. So 85% of the overall harm in the population in their studies in Australia are coming from the low and moderate risk groups. Only 15% of the total harm is from the problem gambling category. And that really caused a lot of people to change the way that they thought about this state of affairs.
Anything to that?
Good.
Okay. So on that point, I think we've been talking about this again around the State of the Union on, do we actually have an understanding of what at-risk play is? And, you know, my quantitative survey brain is, if you guys were to evaluate us, would you say we're at a one in terms of we don't really know what risk looks like and we have no clue versus maybe a five where we're like, actually, we know exactly what risk is and we kind of have definitions. Like, where would you say we are in my basic scale?
If you ask me, I would probably say I'm between four and five. We know for sure what problem gambling is. Mm-hmm. We know how to identify it. The problem is how to deal with it mm-hmm. and what to do. So I don't know if you agree with me.
I think I would give us a bit of a higher score, maybe like a 6.5, because I think that, as an example, the work done by the Division on Addiction on the earliest kind of predictive modeling work that was done in our field, you know, over and over again, there were four sets of indicators that were strongly correlated with self-exclusion or developing a gambling problem or, you know, responding on a brief screen that suggested you had a gambling problem. Many different events they were trying to predict. And in some cases, just a concept called extreme play. And in each case, there were these kind of like four types of behaviors that were good, clear indicators of risk. There's been lots of work to build on that. So I would say, yeah, we do know what risk behavior looks like. There are places we're not looking yet, which would be the reason for the part of the reason for the 6.5. Things like ATM withdrawals or how players access cash to gamble, stuff like that, communication behaviors, those kinds of things. But the other reason I would not give us a higher score is because we're not doing what we need to do with that information yet. Mm-hmm. We're not actually intervening when we see risk behavior mm-hmm. in some kind of an escalated response protocol. It isn't there.
You just changed the scale on me and went to 10.
I was
so don't worry.
Yeah,
I got you. It's okay. I got you, though. Because like, you did one of these, and like, it's a 5-point scale. But she went to the 10.
Oh, yeah,
it's okay.
Translate it back.
It's okay. It's probably going
to
be a 3.
And
a
3.
So I actually gave it a lower score than Pear.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay.
Sorry. No, cool. I missed that, Pear.
No, but I think the point, and I'll get to you, too, is I think if we're a 6.5 out of 10 or we're a 4 out of 5, like the conversation here is and we'll get to Luke, is, you know, we're there. What's the actual challenges that we're dealing with right now as an industry? If we're kind of saying we have information, we have some information on behavioral risks, what do we actually think the barrier is for us to move it to action? Like, where would you kind of see that being? Because that's kind of why we're here, is like, you know, we had this conversation earlier today about industry and academics needing to come closer and there's more collaboration needing to happen. Okay, we get that point. But in terms of, we have some information out here, you know, what is it that you think we need to move us into action?
First of all, you need data. Mm-hmm. If you have data, you can also try and start testing what works, what don't work. And you always get this ongoing results to go further. And when you find something that works, you could try A/B testing more and more and more. And maybe in the end, you get this best practice and you have to share with the other operators, for instance. Mm-hmm. But data is crucial here. If you don't have data, you don't have the answers, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're at another shift from identifying to knowing how to respond to that knowledge. I think we can measure the signs of problem gambling very well and very reliably. One of the challenges with behavioral tracking is that you can't ask people questions about symptoms or about harms. You're trying to infer that from behavioral expressions, and there's another step there. Right. But the bigger challenge is more how do we actually use that knowledge to guide a response and an intervention?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would add, I agree with those barriers. I would add that I think even without intending it, we're having a bit of a romance with predictive analytics. You know, it's so lovely and delightful to keep refining these models. Yeah. We have to actually do something with them. Mm-hmm. And that predictive modeling has enabled us to learn amazing things. Like, for example, over time, we can see trajectories of play and how certain indicators escalate, you know. And so I think that to some extent, we're so focused on getting this perfect model that we're missing the fact that we've already learned so much that we could be putting into action in gambling settings.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I was just thinking, I'm going off the script, obviously, sorry. But I was just thinking about this whole thing about the testing and learn and willing to take the risks to actually try to evaluate what we're doing. We take those risks in like marketing, for example, where the digital world is now allowing us a platform to test messages, test creative elements, test all these things. And so is the barrier for us trying to do that from a player health perspective or an RG perspective is because we just aren't entirely sure about the space still? Or like, what would you guys kind of say like the risk of or kind of the barrier is for not trying some of these tests?
I think if you compare it to sales and marketing, we're quite good at using the data set. I mean, CRM, we are messages sent, everything, relevant messages. And if you bring the same thought into the RG features, mm-hmm. and you can still use the same set of business rules, actually, mm-hmm. to start going there.
But what would you say the barrier, though, is for us to start going there, then?
I'm not sure, but you just have to start. It's like intervening on proactive calls. The first telephone call is always the worst one. Mm-hmm. So you just have to start.
Yeah.
Just as simple.
Yeah. Do you guys have anything to add on?
Well, I was going to say, and start small.
Yeah.
Start, you know, like look at your 98th percentile on session length. Or, start with something fairly simple that's a reliable indicator that the player might be experiencing risk, and start with a very light touch on the intervention. Maybe you start with just promoting self-awareness, you know, and then you encourage self-control. Say, hey, maybe we could steer you to these tools. You might benefit from a self-assessment, you know. Like, so just, I think we need a framework that says it's okay to start small with simple indicators and an escalating response. And I think people will start to do it. But it is a bit scary. We need to plunge into the pool.
Mm-hmm. Before I give everybody a chance to ask a question or if there's any question in the audience, maybe just on that point, Judith, if you were to be asked, like, how would you define what at-risk play is, like, what would you kind of say that is today? Yeah. Or what would be...
So, I think... risky play is play that, if you look at the definition of kind of any form of addiction, it's persistence, in the face of negative consequences. So I think that, you know, from that we can say that when players are doing things that a lot of other players don't do, you know, in the face of a series of losses, the normal thing is to scale down your bets and to step away from the machine and take a break. If you start escalating, you know, well, we know that that's someone who's likely in a bit of trouble, mm-hmm. panicking, anxious, needing to pay for a wedding.
Mm-hmm. yeah. How about you, Liz, in terms of defining what it would look like?
Yeah, like as a psychologist, I would naturally approach things in a similar way. But another way that we can look at this is a data-driven approach. So we've been doing some work at the Center for Gambling Research using a year data set from the PlayNow platform, and it's from the e-casino section, so the slot machines and table games. And we have about 30,000 users in that data set, and they're making about 500 million bets, and we're building machine learning models to predict self-exclusion as the outcome there. And we put a lot of betting behavioral inputs into the model. So we put 20 inputs in, which reflects the kinds of things that Judith's been talking about there, the intensity, the frequency. We've got some variability measures. We've got, we haven't really got trajectory measures, but you could think about trajectories too. And we are seeing 75% performance accuracy just off of those kind of play measures. So that would be compared to a 50% chance level. We're at around 75%, where we know very little about who these people are at all. That's all the data that we're working with. You can then say which are the variables there that have the most signal, mm-hmm. and the single variable that we see that has by far the most signal is the variability in the bet-to-bet spend. So it's not a player who is consistently betting high. It's a player who from one session to the next is low one day and high the next. And what we need to figure out next is if that is in itself a kind of expression of chasing, or if this is more about access to funds and when payday is and things like that. But in that sense, we're letting the models determine the variables that give you the most leverage.
Mm-hmm. I do think, though, there's a bit of a problem with having the target be self-exclusion or, you know, some measure of gambling disorder.
Right.
You know, and I'm not sure I have the solution. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of minds here who have contributed to that conversation. But certainly the whole trend toward identifying what behaviors are protective or at least not risky, and then trying to, you know, push players toward those behaviors teaches us something too. So instead of trying to identify the folks who will self-exclude in the future, can we identify the folks who aren't exercising kind of well-documented and evidenced safe gambling practices?
Right. I think like for that conversation too is if, you know, VSC isn't the dependent variable that we should be focusing on as an example for the data kind of nerds here, because there's some false positives that you mentioned and these other things. Mm. But if one of the variables that you guys just agreed on is variance of play, you mean identifying that within your data could be a trigger and a target for, you know, operators to say, okay, we're going to look at, you know, this is the normal level of variance that we have. Anytime a player goes outside of that, is there an action or something? Would that be something similar to where we could probably go, I guess? And I think you have the experience to tell us if that's something that you guys would do there.
But again, I have to say that if you have just a limited set of data, mm-hmm. you don't have the whole picture.
Sure.
So you need actually a single point of customer data. Mm-hmm. We can track all this customer behavior and also everything really with the customer. I don't know if that was the answer for the question.
Sure. But, no, I get it. So it's hard to just look at it by just one channel, for example.
Of course. Because you need to have the total picture.
Yeah.
You could still just respond lightly to some of those individual behaviors, but you do start to need what I think you're implying, which is some form of of case management, mm-hmm. where you're understanding that for some risk indicators, we need to take a closer look. Is this variability happening in an escalating fashion over the last few weeks, or is it a one-time thing where someone got carried away and maybe had too much to drink?
We had fun last night, okay?
Like, it was like, like someone might have last night, you know.
Any questions from the audience on that? Because we kind of talked a little bit about that. Oh, yeah, Sam. Oh, we have a mic runner here. Okay.
Hi. The word data has come up quite a bit in the conversation so far. I'm curious. I'm a marketer by trade, and so there's kind of two forces at play that seem to be coming for marketers. So one is the technology and what we can do with the data that we have at our disposal. The other is privacy. And it seems like the two are at odds with one another. I'm curious if any of you feel that as privacy becomes more of a public issue, do you see it forcing us to take a few steps back in terms of the progress that we've made from a player health perspective?
I would actually do the opposite. I think that what we should do is tell our players, research shows that these are the kinds of behaviors that behaviors that we believe exhibit risk for harm, mm-hmm. and we're going to be tracking these behaviors, and we're going to talk to you, we're going to communicate with you if we're concerned. Imagine doing that as an operator. I think you'd skirt the privacy concerns quite effectively, and people would appreciate you for it.
I think that's a very good question, because when you ask the player himself, when you intervene and call him, for instance, he would probably say, why didn't you call me before? So until now we have...
Well, and that's a good point, because I think that the sensitivity around privacy is often voiced by the operator, but I think that if you surveyed your players, they think you know everything about them. Mm. They do. They think you know how much oxygen they're breathing in your facility, really. So these concerns about privacy should be checked with your players. Do you think we know these things about you? Do you mind if we use them to help you?
And if you know it, why don't you tell me?
Yes.
They assume that everything's being tracked.
They do. They assume it. Because it is in every other aspect of our lives, you know?
Yeah, that's correct.
Increasingly.
Within banking, for instance, if you open your bank and only see the 70% of the information, how would you react?
Any other questions from the audience? Jamie? Yeah.
Hi. Per, can you just talk a little bit about the phone calls, the protocols around that, and the reception, how receptive players have been for receiving that phone call?
I'm not sure if... did you hear Jacob Johnson here last year? A few of you maybe did. But when you call the at-risk players, it's the highest risk players. And the protocol is like, what do you call it? Looking for the words.